There is a substance that has potential to provide sustainable power, new medicines, and actually pretty good fertilizer. But it's a substance that people usually thumb their noses at. Poo. Or whatever you'd like to call it. Fecal matter, black gold, doo-doo, dung, excrement. It's an excellent multitasker, and we're wasting it, says Dr. Bryn Nelson. Bryn is a journalist and author who specialises in scientific and environmental stories, and he says it's time to set aside potty humour and re-examine our attitudes towards human waste as a potential resource. He shares the fecal facts and innovations happening all over the world with poo in his new book, which is called Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. And Dr. Bryn Nelson joins me now from Seattle. Hello there.
Hi, Jesse. Thank you so much for having me.
The puns start at the beginning, Bryn. You have a dedication for mom and dad with love from your number two son. But this is actually a very serious subject, one we obsess over, as you point out, with our babies and our dogs. I mean, I have to ask, was there a time in your life when you were obsessed with your own internal plumbing?
Well, that's a good question. I would say that I have become much more aware of it, over the course of the years. I'm a microbiologist by training, so I guess I've already had a long history with microbes, and I think the microbiome is particularly fascinating to me, and the fact that we still don't know what a lot of these microbes do. You know, we've co-evolved with them. They live inside of us. It's like this whole jungle of organisms, and we know that they play a huge role in keeping us safe, preventing disease, or if they're out of balance, causing disease. But I was just fascinated with the idea that our own internal plumbing is still a bit of a black box, so to speak. And as part of the book, I tried to describe what poo is, how we make it, and why we should care about it.
Yeah, and is the disdain we have for human dung, is that indicative of a bigger issue, the idea that we're somehow different from animals and nature? We're sort of above the ecosystem rather than part of it.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think part of it really goes to the emotion of disgust. And we know that disgust is very powerful, and it has evolved in part to keep us safe. So we tend to find bodily fluids icky, things that can make us sick, whether they're roaches or rats or slimy things. And so there is a role for that. I think the problem is that sometimes that diet gets turned up a little too high, and it can work against our own best interest. And so I think one of the things that I like to tell people and to communicate in the book is that nature has had this recycling system, very efficient recycling system, in place for millions of years. So when we die, when animals, other things die, the nutrients return to the earth. Well, poo is another way for these nutrients also to be returned. And I think through, in part, our own disgust, we have kind of sequestered that away in landfills, or tried to burn it in some cases. And we have basically taken what's a very useful resource and put it in a place where it's least useful. And so, yeah, I think part of the point of the book is to get us to rethink our role as producers, not just consumers, but producers of what happens to be this very versatile and very abundant natural resource.
Yeah. And if you do think of us as part of a wider ecosystem, does it have an impact removing our waste from that ecosystem?
Absolutely. One of the studies that I looked at that was just fascinating to me looked at the role of megafauna, so huge animals back in the Pleistocene, so 20,000 years ago, back when we had these land giants, also whales, and their role in basically moving nutrients like phosphorus across the landscape. And as part of of this recycling system. And so through the loss of those animals, as well as through human actions, we have actually disrupted some of these recycling systems. So if you think of phosphorus, nitrogen, even water recycling, you know, there's this kind of mechanism that's been in place for a long time. And so, yes, you know, by kind of removing ourselves from this cycle, we're very much causing environmental harm, because in many cases, what we're doing is we're putting our poo in the worst possible place, or you know, letting it run off into to streams and bodies of water unchecked. And so there's kind of a glut of nutrients when nature has this very sort of efficient system. So you know, we can create all kinds of problems by putting waste where it shouldn't go. And, you know, certainly there are a lot of diseases linked to a lack of sanitation as well. So, you know, hurting ourselves in the process. And so I think just kind of rethinking our role in this and basically rejoining the rest of nature, I think can not only help us keep from harming the rest of the planet, but also help us actively start to heal it.
You've had a good look at our digestive system as part of your work. How impressive is it?
It's a pretty impressive system. And I think, you know, part of what's fascinating to me is that we still don't really know all of the details of this. You know, there may or may not be, you know, even extra salivary glands that were just discovered. And there's a, you know, debate as to their role in digestion. So we know kind of the broad contours of digestion. But, you know, as part of this project, I had my own microbiome sequenced to kind of figure out what species were living with me. And what I was surprised about is well over half of the microbes, we have very little idea of what they're actually doing. And so many of them may be working together as a community and, you know, creating compounds and other useful things. We know that some microbes help us absorb nutrients. Some help us digest plant fibers. Some of them help keep bad microorganisms, disease-causing microorganisms at bay, and many of them work together. And the microbiome is most prevalent in the lower intestinal tract in your colon. And I think there's a lot of excitement and a lot of research now because we're realizing just how much this part of the digestive system may have a much broader role in other parts of the body. So I think there's plenty left for us to discover. And I think that's, you know, that's part of why I'm excited about it, is because, you know, there's a lot of potential to basically help solve some other medical conditions.
You talked about disgust earlier, and that's kind of one of the reasons why we might not be more open to using human waste in useful ways. But we should say that disgust is actually an evolved defense mechanism, right? It serves us well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, I mean, we have the sort of the broad capacity for disgust. It is something that has evolved with us. People usually talk about three categories of disgust. The most common is pathogen disgust, and that's basically a disgust of those things that might make us sick. There's also moral disgust and sexual disgust. And if you do these kind of disgust scales or surveys, all across the world, you know, poo is pretty much at the top of the list, as are some other bodily functions. And again, yeah, it's, you know, we know that if we mishandle it, it can be very dangerous. You know, there are diarrheal diseases that kill millions around the world. So unquestionably, this is a very dangerous substance if we don't treat it with respect, if we don't treat it properly. You know, but at the same time, Sometimes that disgust can get in the way of actually a lot of benefit. And one example of that is the way in which fecal transplants have been used to actually cure intestinal infections. So there's an infection called Clostridioides difficile, or C. diff. It's a hospital-acquired infection, and it results from an invasion of this microbe in an unbalanced gut system. And a fecal microbiota transplant is nothing more than basically replanting someone's inner garden. So you're taking basically the microbes, the gut microbes from a healthy person, and you're transplanting them into the sick individual. And people who are on their deathbeds have been cured and basically restored to health within a day. So it's an absolutely remarkable type of medical therapy. But for many years, it was blocked because of the disgust factor. Doctors didn't want to do it. People were disgusted even talking about it. And in this case, that disgust was literally deadly for a lot of people, unfortunately. So that's been another kind of fascinating evolution of what was this kind of laughed at fringe therapy that's now very solidly within the medical mainstream.
I'm talking to Dr. Bryn Nelson, an author and journalist who specializes in scientific and environmental stories, and his latest book is called Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. We're talking about the potential benefits of human waste. So that's a bit of an idea of how it might work as medicine. What about the potential for it as a biofuel, Bryn?
Yeah, so this is another really fascinating application, and this is something that is happening in New Zealand and all over the world. And this is the potential for basically turning our wastewater into biogas, and specifically into biomethane. So we all, many of us, produce biogas as a natural process. The microbes living in our gut produce it as part of their metabolism. And wastewater treatment plants have figured out how to kind of mimic this process. And so they have these huge vats called biodigesters. And what they do is they've kind of recreated the human gut, except in a very large scale. And under these conditions, the organic material in the wastewater actually acts as food to feed these microbes. And as a result of their kind of feeding frenzy, they are creating biogas as a byproduct. And so this biogas can be produced in very large volumes, and it can be used to generate electricity. It can be used to generate heat. It can even be used to power vehicles like buses. So one of the wastewater treatment plants that I visited in Norway is actually using the biogas to power some of their city buses. So it's a very, very extraordinarily useful product. And so you're seeing some of these biogas plants pop up all over the world. But there's still a huge potential for more of this production.
Yeah. And what would have to happen to tap into that source of energy at scale?
Well, I think part of it is it comes down to investment. We know that a number of our wastewater treatment plants are getting on in years, and we need to sort of rethink what they are, what they could be. And one of the exciting trends in the field is that a lot of wastewater treatment plants are kind of reinventing themselves as resource recovery facilities. So you're basically taking what everyone thinks of as a waste product and then seeing how many different useful things you can extract from it. So biogas, of course, is one, but there are other things. You can extract phosphorus and then reuse it as fertilizer. You can extract biosolids, which are the solids that are left over after the cleaning process. And that can be composted and converted into a soil amendment. So there are all kinds of these different products that can be created. What needs to happen, I think, around the world is sort of a commitment to fund and rethink some of these facilities so that there can be this kind of large return on investment. But yeah, it requires some long-range planning and some upfront money, of course.
Okay. I remember hearing some horror stories about North Korea. It was a few years ago, this idea of night soil, that they didn't have access to fertilizer, and so they were using human excrement and all the sort of the negative health impact and pathogens that was creating. But yet there is a serious theory around human waste as fertilizer. Was that hyperbole what I was hearing out of North Korea back then, or are we talking about two different things here?
Well, again, I think one of the things that I do want to emphasize is that if poo is not handled properly, it can be very dangerous. Mm. You know, we know that that it can carry diseases. So there is a sort of double-edged sword here, and I think the difference is in how it's processed and how it's treated. And we know how to do that now. We know how to treat it so that we're killing all of the pathogens from it before we reuse it. So I think that's key, you know, is that you have to be very careful with your testing and with your regulations and making sure that you are not just spreading raw waste because, right. Yes, you can make people sick. But I think what we're seeing now is the technology is there for a lot of these wastewater treatment plants to convert this into a very safe soil amendment. And so if you're able to reduce or in many cases completely eliminate all of the disease-causing microbes, you can use this as a very potent fertility aid for both gardens as well as agricultural sites.
As well as the practical considerations and the social license, there will also be new ethical questions, I imagine, like if you turn human waste into profit, who gets to benefit, for example? Have you thought about any of those questions?
Yes, absolutely. And part of this goes back to kind of the medical applications of this. And one of the things I think is very interesting as well as very disturbing is that for many of us, we have diets that are high in fat, high in carbohydrates, low in fiber. We're exposed to antibiotics. Many of us have a sedentary lifestyle. And what's happened as a result of that is that the gut microbes, the diversity of them has actually decreased. So we're actually losing microbes from our gut that we used to have. And so researchers have begun to look elsewhere. You know, so who has the most diversity in their gut microbiomes? And it turns out that often it is communities that have very little exposure to antibiotics and have diets that are very high in fiber. So these are communities in the Amazon rainforest, for example, some other communities in Africa. And so that raises a very important ethical question of how will these communities benefit from this resource, right? If we're looking to some of these microbes to potentially supply some of the functions that we've lost, to potentially help us fight off some of these diseases, how do we do it in a way that doesn't further exploit, you know, many of these communities that have, you know, suffered exploitation, have suffered violence, have had many of their natural resources stripped? So I think that's a really important ethical question, and I think the field very much needs to be addressing that as well as we move forward.
You've been out spreading these ideas and testing the waters. How far away do you think we are from being able to think of some of these things as options? given that the disgust and the ick factor is real.
Right. So I wanted the book to be a hopeful book. And I sincerely believe that a lot of the technology and the know-how is already here. You know, a lot of these technologies aren't new. It's just that we're making them more efficient, or we're combining them in ways to make them better. So the hurdle really isn't a scientific hurdle at this point for many of these reuses. It's more a psychological hurdle. It's more, in some cases, a political hurdle. And so I think what needs to happen is that along with the technology, along with the engineers that are pushing this forward, we also need to include some of the social scientists, so psychologists, sociologists, to make sure that we're educating people, getting them comfortable, helping them understand that the benefits outweigh the risks, but being honest and transparent. You know, this is what we know, this is what we don't know, this is how it may help you and your community. So I think there's a ton of potential there. I think it's not years away. I think it's you know, a lot of these projects could be started today, you know, if we had the willpower to do so. But yes, it will take some time to, I think, convince some members of the public. But in some applications, such as water reclamation, we know that water availability is already a crisis for many parts of the world, and we know how to reclaim safe drinking water from this. So I think, you know, in many cases, the current drought conditions in many parts of the world have created kind of an opening, you know, for this message to come through.
In the meantime, I know you're a fan of the adage quality in, quality out. What's the best stuff we should be eating or drinking to be helping our own internal systems?
That's a great question. So I'm not a nutritionist. I'll start with that. But from kind of my own experience and reading, I think what has come through is that people need to be thinking about a diverse source of vegetables. So your parents were right when they asked you to eat your vegetables. And it's not just vegetables, it's a diversity of vegetables. In addition to that, fermented foods can be very helpful for the gut. So things like yogurt, sauerkraut, kimchi, other fermented foods. So the combination of fermented foods that are supplying some of these microbes, and then the food source for the microbes, which is actually this diversity of fibers that you can get in vegetables, you know, together, I think those can go a long way towards improving gut health.
Hey, great work on this book. Really interesting stuff. And I'm sure it's not the last we'll hear of these ideas. The book's called Flush, The Remarkable Science of an Unlikely Treasure. And I've been talking to the author, Dr. Bryn Nelson. Thanks, Bryn.
Thanks so much, Jesse.